This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. How are you doing this evening?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice again, Nate.
All right. So you just came back from this Never Too Late basketball camp. How was it?
Oh, God. Yeah, it was good. It was very good. Good time.
Well, I didn't mean to bring it up other than one of our listeners informed us in the Facebook group. He went to there was a Twitter congratulating you, dear. It said, "Doctor." I go with "Dear Dr. Lyle" because that's basically what I read on the show. But it actually said, "Doug Lyle of Sacramento stuns the never too late world by making 69 out of 80 in the famed 80 shot drill at the Oregon weekend camp." Congratulations to the first time camper, Doug. So, Dr. Lyle, I guess you can ball.
Well, all right. So I'll tell the story as long as we're here. So it turns out they have this 80-shot drill, and Alan Goldhammer and I are there, and we're both technically excellent shooters. And so we do this. It's the first night, and we do our thing. I think I hit 69. I think Alan hit 64. We're both, like, totally disgusted with ourselves. Like, we definitely are better than that. So we so we go up to report it to the head honcho. And he goes, "Well, how many?" I said, 69. And he looks at me and he goes, "You hit 69? I said, "Yeah." He goes, "That's the all-time high score for the history of the camp." So this, I have to tell you, anybody out there that's a ball player, I mean, all I can say is that the camp, that's a little, that's very surprising because I'm going to talk Alan into going back to this thing, and I fully intend to set the bar quite a bit higher when I go back. But anyway, so it was definitely a fun camp, and I will say another thing that was interesting, and that was that Alan and I, the last basketball camp we went to is probably John Wooden's camp in about 1974. Okay, so it's been kind of a while since we went to a basketball camp. And so I actually didn't expect to learn anything from this camp. Alan's and my intention was to just go there and just beat up on a bunch of old men. That was the total intent. Okay. And we were a little worried because we thought, well, there's some other old guys out there that are probably pretty good, but we figured with our healthy diets and everything, we're going to womp on a bunch of old geezers. So that was totally the plan. So we get there, and, of course, we're the oldest guys in the camp. There's all kinds of young guys in the camp. We're like, oh, okay, it's a little different than we thought. So then we didn't expect to learn anything. So our attitude was, we know how to play this game. So it turns out that, of course, which never really occurred to me, that everything in the world, folks, continues to evolve. And in fact, if we were to think about it, the general innovation rate for a free society is probably about 3% a year. And so it occur to me that basketball has evolved. I mean, I knew that with the three-point shot line, of course, all the young kids today can shoot from deep better than we could when I was a kid because we were never shooting that far. But that doesn't impress me. But what I didn't know was that at the high level of basketball, which these coaches teach at, there's all kinds of very subtle tricks that were never taught to me, and I've never seen them before. And so it was fascinating to it was a very kind of a very unusual camp because there's only 20 of us. In the old days, there'd be 200 kids at a camp. There's only 20 of us there, of us, and these coaches are very sophisticated. And so I cannot wait now to practice some of my new fundamentals for some very tricky stuff and then womp on all the young kids that I play with in my community. And now they call me OG, the old guy. Well, now the old guy has the old dog has some new tricks, and I'm really looking forward to it. So truly, it's never too late to learn, and Alan and I learned some stuff, so we're gonna have a good time this next year honing our new game. So that's the story of our basketball.
That sounds pretty fun. I almost want to go. I've never played basketball before, so that's,
there
you
go. Get
to walk
well, it's very cool. All right, let's go on.
All right, so this week the name of the show is Six Romantic Gestures That Are Major Red Flags When Dating.
One of them is when old guys brag about their athleticism. Just everybody. Okay, go ahead.
Well, this is from a magazine called Cosmopolitan, which I'm sure a few of our listeners have read. So yeah. We're going to dissect it and see what we can learn from some of the lessons that they're giving us. So the article starts with saying that most people want a partner who's attentive, caring, and if they're looking for an exclusive relationship, actually committed. But sometimes if you follow the advice of movies that teach you to admire grand romantic gestures, your potential partner's behavior could actually be covering up some serious flaws. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Number one romantic gesture that is a serious red flag is they profess their love very early on.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on how they say it, according to Dr. Mariana Bakarova, who teaches relationship psychology at University of Toronto. She says it's normal to feel infatuated very quickly if you really like someone, but if a person says something as huge as, I'm completely in love with you, or I know you're my soulmate and I want to spend the rest of my life with you, only a few weeks into dating, you should take a few steps back. While the doctor says, I would tread carefully with someone making extremely grand gestures before they know you. Be cognizant that long-lasting and healthy love takes communication, trust, reliability, and genuine care, which takes some time to build.
Yeah, good thinking on the doc's part. I don't disagree with this. So let's continue on to hear what it is that she has to say, and then I'll give my feedback from evolutionary psychology about why this is true so that we can actually look under the hood and understand the mechanics of why this is happening. But let's hear more. Tell me more about what she has to say.
Okay, so she says, although this is not true in all cases, this sort of behavior is quite common, unfortunately, among controlling, abusive, or narcissistic partners. So that was the first romantic gesture. The second one is to overshare on a first date. It's easy to think that someone who reveals a lot on a first date immediately feels connected to you, particularly when they go into detail about their childhood and they're not afraid to open up a little bit. But be cautious if the conversation turns to past relationships. If they ramble about their past dating experiences or verbally rip apart people they've been with, they may not be in the right place to start a new relationship. The third one is they chat you up nonstop. It's perfectly natural to text and talk a lot. It's certainly more romantic than the guy who takes 4 days just to text you back a one-word response. But overdoing it on the videos and the memes, that can be a bad sign. They may simply attach to romantic partners quickly and be unaware that the amount of communication is overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Number four is they want to spend all of their time with you. Theoretically, the idea of just can't get enough of you sounds flattering because, in fact, they're recognizing that you're an awesome human being to be around. But if you're a new date, wants to come over to your place every night, even when you make it clear that you're working or the friends, or you just want a night to yourself, you better look out. Requests for more quality time together can become toxic and unhealthy when you feel pressured or are actively made to feel guilty for wanting to spend time on interests or with other people other than your partner.
Mm-hmm.
Number five is they're very protective of you. I love you too much to imagine you with anyone else. May sound sweet at first, but often it can cloak a very unhealthy form of jealousy. Dr. Bakarova says jealousy is a normal response to a real threat to a relationship. And it's an evolutionary emotion humans feel when they suspect their relationship is in danger. However, irrational jealousy can be a sign your partner is controlling. Number six is they make sweeping, grandiose promises. It's not that saying something like, I would never hurt you, is inherently bad, but sometimes the people who dramatically promise they'll never leave or hurt you are precisely the ones who do. So it's best to pay attention to a person's actions and values first before wholeheartedly latching onto their words. Adding that a disconnect between words and behaviors could leave you feeling hurt and disappointed in the long run. So these are the six. She says, all in all, partners who make grand romantic gestures aren't always. I swear I know how to read.
Yeah, it's okay.
All in all, partners who make grand romantic gestures aren't always the best long-term partners, regardless of how they express their devotion to you. Only time will tell whether they listen to you, appreciate your flaws, respect your independence, and make you feel loved in a real way.
Yeah, so let's look. All this is true. Doc's doing a good job there. Let's now look under the hood, down into the mechanics, just for our listeners, so that you can see a little bit more clearly why this is happening. What's happening? Let's take a very wide lens view. And we're not going to talk about a romance specifically. We're going to talk about motivation. So what motivation is movement. And it's the willingness of the organism to expend energy to move. So it moves with a motive. In other words, it's trying to close the distance between where it is now and where it could be in order to obtain some value. And whatever that value is, that value has some internally recognized calculus for how that value lines up to all other values that are within the organism's ability to possibly obtain. So what the organism has is a universal value system for that particular species. So if you're a chipmunk and you're looking at a little nut or a little acorn, you have a certain amount of motivation to close the distance between you and that acorn. And that lines up to all other values that are involved. So it may be pretty valuable for you. You may not have seen an acorn for a while. You may not have a lot of acorns in your stack. But you have a certain amount of essentially vector force that is pushing you to go get that acorn. But if it turns out there's a predator in the direction of that acorn, then that vector is pushing you further away. So what the brain is essentially it's a gambling machine that runs probabilities in order to triangulate behavior on a path to it's essentially organizing the contraction and relaxation of muscles. And in order to move the organism around its environment in a way that will optimize gene survival. So that's what the brain is it's essentially a behavior handicapper, and it handicaps like a horse handicapper in a horse race tries to figure out, you know, which horse is likely to win and by what the odds are, et cetera, et cetera. This is exactly what the brain is doing for behavior as it scans the environment, calculates all known options for behavior by analyzing all major values and threats in the environment, and then arrives at a certain amount of motivation for different particular major options, and then selects the option that it believes is in fact the option of highest genetic efficiency. So that's what it is. Now, you can so the genetic efficiency is going to drive different feelings. So your feelings are essentially an analog feedback system. Think of, for example, let's suppose that if you were doing a dance routine in front of 10,000 people on the internet, and as you're doing your moves in real time, every 5 seconds, there's an integrated set of feedback that they play a little tone that tells you, you know, what the 10,000 people think. And so let's suppose that you're doing lousy, then the tone is low and it goes boom, like that means lousy. And then if you do a little better, or they think your moves are better, the next 5 seconds it goes boom, and then it's like think woo, like ah, really high. Okay, so we had an analog feedback system that moves up and down a scale to give you feedback about whether or not your dance routine is being is popular or not. That's what emotions are. Emotions are an analog feedback system that is giving you a feedback sense of how valuable various alternative courses of action are. So what's going to happen is that if you go to the sale at Macy's and you look at the thing and you're like, it's the same damn sale I saw a month ago. In fact, I think I remember these things were 35% off a month ago, and now they're 25% off. What kind of joke is that? People raised the price by 10% in the last month. I'm not interested. Okay. So, however, if you go today and it turns out, we've got a end of season clearance sale, 65% off. You're like, whoa, these things were 35% off a month ago. Now they're 65. Basically, the price has been cut in half. Oh my God, I want to stack up. So let's look inside your nervous system and see what we're seeing. We're seeing a motivation to contract the muscles in order to obtain those values, and we have excitement in the system. So the system is excited. It's basically saying, this is really worth doing. So there is a lot of energy expenditure in order to aggressively pursue this opportunity. Okay? The reason why we're doing this is that it's a high efficiency feedback with respect to gene survival, compared to all other behaviors that we could be doing right now, okay? So we could be shining our shoes, we could be having lunch, we could be on the cell phone talking to our friend, we could call our little old mother in Ireland and see how she is, or we could buy these sweaters at Macy's that are 65% off and pick through them and get our size and our colors before anybody else gets them, okay? If we believe that this is the best use of our time and energy right now, that's what we're going to be focused on. If we feel like the opportunity is particularly excellent, in other words, it's a very good opportunity relative to any opportunities we've seen in our habitat in the last 3 weeks, then what's going to happen is the analog feeling system is going to generate a lot of heat, high excitement, okay? And the reason why is the cost benefit. The amount of cost for the behavior to acquire the value versus the amount of benefit is an exceptionally good ratio. But what that means is it means that we can bet that the opportunity is going to be time limited because competitors are going to observe this and somebody is making a shitty trade, okay? Somebody is making a mistake. And while they're making a mistake, we're going to cash in as fast as we possibly can because other people are asleep at the switch, okay? That's what drives excitement. What drives excitement is rare opportunity. A house that you're a house speculator and you like to flip houses. And so you come across a house and you're like, oh my God, the market doesn't know about it yet. It's some little old lady, she's dumping it and she doesn't care. And it's not even listed, and somebody told me about it, and I went and talked to her, and she wants, you know, $65,000 for it because that's $10,000 more than she paid 10 years ago in our little town in Arkansas, and the truth is that I know it's worth $95,000, okay? But she's embarrassed about it because it has bad paint, like fantastic. Are we excited? Yes, we're excited. Okay. Somebody might think, Dr. Lyle, how unethical to steal $30,000 from a little old lady. Okay. That's somebody else's problem. Okay.
It's kind of like beating up on that, on older men at the basketball camp.
There you go. Okay. So anyway, the point is that excitement... Excitement is about the high energy that the system will activate in order to seize a short-term opportunity that is likely to close. Okay, along with that excitement, there is also paranoia. Okay, so there's a feeling that, oh my God, somebody else is going to get it. Okay, so we feel nervous that that opportunity is going to be the person on the other end of this opportunity they are going to wake up. Okay, so this is how this is going to work. So if I'm a gold miner, you know, at Sutter's Fort, I'm paranoid as hell that if I've got a claim that's making money, I'm like, I don't want anybody else to know where my claim is. I don't want to know I don't want them to know how much money I'm making out of the claim. I'm paranoid as hell. Okay, the first thing I'm going to buy is a shotgun and a big dog. Okay, and I'm going to try to keep people off my claim. Now, the underneath that, in a romantic situation, or in any situation, but particularly a romance, this is all about being generated by a cost-benefit analysis that says this is one hell of an opportunity. Essentially, I am being over-rewarded. Okay, it's the concept of being over-rewarded. So everything that you see in this woman's writings, you are seeing the fact that the person, like she's sort of trying to blame this on the personality of the individual on the other side of the fence. That's actually a mistake, okay? So she's saying, okay, these people tend to be narcissistic, or they tend to be this, they tend to be that. This is, you know, it's a pattern that she has seen and the literature may have seen. In other words, it is true that that will happen with such individuals, but she's missing the broader principle that is, in fact, driving the boat that some of those individuals often happen to be in, which is that those individuals feel over-rewarded when they meet somebody kind of interesting because they know they are carrying around substantial liabilities because they're haywire, and they know it, okay? So but not everybody is carrying around major liabilities. So some people that are not narcissistic freaks will also act excited, paranoid, over-rewarded, and have a hell of a lot of energy to try to seize the opportunity. And that is happening not because they're a controlling nutcase or anything else. It's just that they're very excited and they feel over-rewarded. Okay? This is the concept of high energy expenditure in the machine when it feels like it is it has the potential to seize a giant profit of some kind, of any kind, whether it's real estate or whether it's sweaters at Macy's, or whether it's acorns that happen to be all there close tight together, or whether or not it's a romantic opportunity. The very same process is going on. The motivational mechanisms are calculating a high benefit relative to the cost ratio. They understand intuitively that this opportunity is going to be very time limited and therefore under heavy genetic selection pressure. And as a result, what was I going to say? They're feeling pressure to try to get the deal closed. So they're trying to get the person to essentially, you know, be with them, team up with them, etc. Now, some of the characteristics she talks about are a little different. So this is sort of a smattering of different problems, and that's okay. So she's describing things, people that are very open and talking about, you know, their ex and complaining about it. You know, we're looking at some signs of disagreeable humans that feel entitled, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a smattering of problems that are being discussed in this list, but the most overriding issue that they're talking about is actually the high selling energy of the individual that is feeling panicked and paranoid, and essentially is wanting to do a full court press to try to drive this relationship towards exclusivity as fast as they can. They will also make a lot of grandiose promises because they feel over-rewarded and panicked. So what they're going to do is they're going to try to sell future benefits that they cannot currently distribute. And they're going to be trying to minimize their costs. Like, oh, no, I don't need anything for myself. I'm just one of those people that just gives, 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 gives. Okay? So this is the story. Now, so the, obviously, most of the time in a true blue romantic situation, most of the time the male feels some of this. So so from the jump. Because remember, he doesn't have in the Cosmo article, Cosmo in general sold the women. So the article was written from the perspective of a woman being pursued by a male. This dynamic going to be most commonly with males directing high energy towards females because the male feels like he's getting pretty good feedback from a female and he feels over-rewarded by that female's looks. And as a result, he can't see anything particularly objectionable about her personality or her brains. And so as a result, he's kind of fallen all over himself very quickly because essentially she seems to pass all criteria needed for him to be wanting to drive this thing towards exclusivity very quickly. So he's selling very high benefit and hiding costs. He is essentially leaking his anxiety. He feels paranoid. He feels potentially over rewarded. He's very excited. And the gambling machine is generating a buy signal very, very hard. And just like a buyer on Wall Street, that he's panicked, half panicked to try to grab as much of the stock as he can. Now, so some of this is reasonable. To some degree, if you don't have this dynamic, we don't have that good a dynamic. So we need to see some of it if you're a female. The male needs to be chomping at the bit a little bit to some significant extent. If he's not, then he's not that hot on you. Okay, that's what's taking place. Unless he's an unbelievably stable human. But the most stable person I ever knew, when he went out with his would-be wife for the first time, he was closing pretty hard, even on date one, okay? Because he was pretty damn sure this was the one, and it turned out it was. So anyway, I forget where I'm wandering with this. So what would I say? I would say don't be turned off by the excitement. Don't be turned off by a little paranoia. Don't be turned off by little possible hints of stress around jealousy issues early in the deal. Those are all normal, but if they're very high in intensity, any of them, then we've got a problem. And this is precisely why, by the way, we have the strategy of 10 paid dates. And the reason is we're slowing down any sexual action to a crawl. And the reason we're doing this is this gives you time to vet the underlying personality characteristics to see what's under there. And that's why we do it. Because the guy who's merely excited and feels like he's somewhat over-rewarded, which is exactly what you want him to feel, and he's feeling like he's over-rewarded on a superficial level, but he does not feel outclassed ultimately. And what he wants to do is he wants to say, listen, if this is a pair bond deal, trust me, I am going to do everything I can to make this thing at least even for you. I want to make you an offer you can't refuse. I want to show you who it is that I am and what I'm willing to do for you. And that guy is going to be patient and he's going to be selling essentially a long-term steady flow of protection and provision. That's what he's attempting to do, okay? A guy that is actually not really in that situation and has a lot of dirty laundry that he's hiding and has some flaky circuits is trying to close more quickly with far greater move towards deep psychological intimacy and vulnerability and physical intimacy. In other words, that guy's trouble, okay? That's precisely why we cool everybody's jets, slow everything down, and when it turns out that he's fundamentally a flake with a lot of problems, believe me, we're going to know that by date five if we don't know it a lot sooner. All right.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Lai, we have three callers on hold, so we're just going to take them one by one. Caller, she asked me to call her Chippy from San Diego. Chippy from San Diego,
Chippy.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, she's a chippy on the side.
Yes. Hi there, Dr. Lyle. I'm a
Hi,
huge
how are you
fan.
Doing?
Great.
What's that?
What chippy are we talking about?
Yeah, so you're the chippy on the side?
Yes. Well, I'm in a happy non-monogamous pair
What's
bond.
That? What's
I'm
that?
In a happy non-monogamous pair bond. I'm extremely open to experience and agreeable enough to be called a unicorn.
Okay, all right.
All right. So my question is, I'm doing a one-hour talk for a group of about 50 to 100 people, and I would love your input on what an evolutionary psychology perspective would be on my topic.
Okay.
What's your solution to the Me Too movement?
Me Too movement. Okay. The Me Too movement, you're going to help me with this because I'm barely paying attention. So the Me Too movement, I guess, is the notion that I, as a female, and specifically, it's generally what it is, was sexually molested. And is that essentially what it is, or is there more to it? Tell me more.
Yes, so it's about supporting survivors and to end sexual violence against women.
Okay. All right, and so when you say a solution to the Me Too movement, like I don't have any problem with a person that has been molested or worse, you know, speaking up, naming perpetrators, and basically saying, hey, you know, in some ways, what this can do for people that have been harboring some shame or embarrassment about having this happen to them, to see millions of other people say, hey, it happened to me and I'm a star basketball player in the WNBA, or this happened to me and I'm now CEO of, you know, I don't know, Tabasco Sauce Incorporated, like whatever it is, I don't see anything wrong with that. So when you say a problem of the Me Too movement, tell me what it is, what problem it is that you're referring to.
So how to help support men in approaching women's sexuality, how to have a healthy sexual expression, how to help sexual, victims or survivors move forward in their, you know, sexualization.
Well, I don't think there's a single scrap of evidence that indicates that anybody who was molested has any arrest in their sexual, you know, evolution. So right away we have an incorrect premise on the part of this movement. So the movement, it was an unpleasant situation that took place in the past, and it's an unpleasant memory to reconsider. But it did not derail anybody's sexual evolution as a human. So there is no process by which we need to help anybody in this regard because they weren't damaged. Okay? So obviously, there could be rare exceptions to this, but by and large, the implication that these people have been damaged in any way in this arena is a mistake. Okay, so we have we have sort of an incorrect premise on which this is floating. So there's no need to help men try to figure out how to be nicer to women in these arenas because the women aren't damaged. Okay. So that, again, incorrect premise after incorrect premise. And so we don't really have, I don't see this as a problem. I see this as a, I've known many people who were molested, and the molestation is an unpleasant memory. They wish it hadn't happened. And so every now and then, their nervous system, they pick up cues from the environment, and it will rattle them for a little bit in the same way that it might rattle somebody that watched their dog get hit by a car, okay? It's not a pleasant memory to have. So we have our memory system will keep in mind or keep in file drawers incidences that were unpleasant, and when certain cues come up from the environment, it will activate those memories. That is different than looking at unpleasant memories as termites that are eating away at your soul and somehow undermining the foundation of your self-esteem, your self-confidence, or your capacity for happiness, joyful sexuality, or anything else. That is a mistake, okay? And that mistake has its roots in Freudian, psychodynamic psychology that is based on false premise after false premise about the nature of how psychology works. So the bigger answer to your question is there's nothing wrong with the Me Too movement as far as as far as I'm concerned, people normalizing the fact that this is a fairly widespread phenomenon and that they go on to have perfectly normal, excellent lives. It's fine for people to say, isn't this shitty that this happened to me, et cetera, to sort of sensitize the culture in this regard. It's perfectly fine. When we go past this and think that it is a bigger monster that needs, I don't know, government action, criminal justice stuff, and all kinds of witch hunting, the answer is no. We need to recognize it for the for what it is and identify what it is not. It is not something, these experiences are not going to linger in the nervous system and cause the kind of trouble that so many psychologists and lay people believe that they cause. Okay?
Chippy from San Diego, thank you very much for the phone call and the excellent question. All right, our next caller is Andrew from Seattle. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes. Hey, how you doing, Andrew?
Good, good. Thank you. I'm attempting a three to five water fast on my own here in my home.
Yeah.
And I went 40. I went 2 days just fine, and towards the end of the 2 days, I had this big conflict on my head. Like, oh my God, should I feed or not feed? I said, no, I'm going to grab my teeth. I'm going to do this. And my instincts are going, no, I'll go get some food. What are you, nuts? What are you doing? Go get some food. I'm like, no, I can do this. I can do this.
Yeah.
And then my daughter made some watermelons and rice and a couple of potatoes, and I wound up eating a little bit. And, of course, I felt bad afterwards for caving. And I felt good at first, and I felt bad afterwards. So then I went another 24 hours without food at all.
Yeah.
And now I'm sort of lost. I'm not sure how much longer I can continue. How do I grit through that third day? Have I started all over again? I'm kind of like confused.
All right. Well, we're not going to have a long discussion about this. Free country, free world, water fasting is a great idea done under the right circumstances. A lot of people can do a short water fast on their own. If they're young and healthy enough and it's sensible, it's not sensible to go very long on your own. I wouldn't. I would start to caution people if they're going to go more than 72 hours. The not that many people haven't done this and gone more, but the problem is you start to get weak, you start to get tired, and if there's a bunch of food around the house, you're going to get temptation, and then you may not wind up doing a very good job of it, and all is fine. You're not going to wind up damaged or hurt as a result of this, provided that you don't have something really unpleasant that you're trying to deal with. So let's suppose you've got, I don't know, Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or some such thing, and you try to water fast on your own. That's a mistake, okay? If you've got some other medical conditions that you're trying to address that you're fasting on your own, they could be a mistake. You're trying to fast on medications. That's a mistake. So, in other words, this is a vastly useful tool. It's the biggest thing that modern medicine doesn't know. It is absolutely the biggest thing. There are, I don't know, some small number of doctors in the world that know how to do it. And your host on this show, Nathan Gershfeld, Dr. Nathan Gershfeld, is one of those people, okay? He went through many years of outstanding first-class training at the premier research facility for water fasting in the world, which is True North Health Center in Santa Rosa. And so you're playing around with this thing. You're kind of screwing around with it. It's not hurting you to screw around with it. Sounds like you're healthy. You're bouncing around all this. But for you want to get serious, you do 3 days, that's no big deal. You want to go longer and you want to try to address other big things, might be a good idea to go to a place where they got docs around that know what they're doing. Good luck. All good. I've got I got another little friend of mine that's going to do 3 days here in the next started tonight on her water fast. Young, healthy, athletic, no medical problems. Makes sense. There's a reason why she wants to do this. And so this is not something I discourage people from generally, but, be prudent and know what your own situation is. And in general, the old school said, don't water fast without supervision. The new school says, as long as you're healthy and we don't have anything we're particularly worried about becoming destabilized, and if you're on no medications, perfectly reasonable to go 3 days. Any more than that, we suggest that you have somebody looking over your shoulder that knows what they're doing. All right. Good call.
Right.
Good question. What else we got?
Andrew from Seattle, thank you very much for the phone call. Okay. Our next caller. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Caller with the last three numbers are 439. Caller going once. Caller going twice. Caller going three times. Well, I guess they are not there. All right. Well, Dr. Lau, so we had some really good insight about romantic gestures that are major red flags. And it seems like what you're saying is that the girls can usually spot whether or not the guy feels over-rewarded if they can see the anxiety, they can see the nervousness. But if they delay the sexual contact and they kind of keep spotting the guy, then he'll actually reveal himself, all of his personality characteristics that may be dangerous will actually, and red flags may actually reveal himself in due time.
Right. We just need a little bit of time, a little bit of background. And that's all we really need, just to slow down the likelihood of making a mistake you don't want to make. That's the idea. I have one more thing I want to talk about. A good friend of mine called me or texted me and asked me about, there's a new movie out. I can't remember the name of it. It's like, Identical Strangers or something like that, something of this nature. It's the story of these triplets who were separated at birth and then found each other in New York, you know, in the late 1970s. And it's a documentary, and it's a fascinating story. And unfortunately, of course, the filmmakers do a remarkable job of not finding the gold that's sitting right in the middle of their living room. I mean, it's actually entertaining for me to watch, like, a bunch of blind people stumbling into the elephant and not seeing it for what it is. It turns out that these three young boys were separated at birth, and it was done the way that it was done through an adoption agency in New York, and it happened to be run by members of the Jewish faith. And not surprisingly, what was connected with that was a psychodynamic psychologist or psychiatrist, I believe he was. Psychiatrist. Let's blame him. We're going to say he's a psychiatrist because I think he was. Besides, I'm a psychologist, so I just assumed it was a psychiatrist. Okay. So this was apparently a very big shot psychiatrist, big high muckety muck in the New York psychoanalytic circles. Now, what this guy did, he was like some Austrian, which makes him almost a German. And what he did was really shitty. Okay. So what this guy did was that he hand selected three different types of parents and separated these three boys out so that he could observe their development under three different types of parents for whom he had, therefore, they were fitting a psychodynamic profile that he expected then to be able to, you know, blow away the world and show that when we put these three identical kids in these three different psychodynamically charged environments, we get three very different outcomes. Okay. This is clearly what this guy was up to. And he was trying to do legitimate research, but it was really shitty and unethical as hell. Okay. This is not what you should have done. Hell, the guy'd be in prison if he pulled a stunt like this today. So what turns out, you know, the famous last words, we're going to do this study. Well, what happens is these kids run into each other. And it becomes this incredible story all over the pages of the New York Times. And so they become rock stars. And they're on all kinds of TV shows, you know, I don't know, Phil Donahue and Dave Cavett or whatever the hell, okay? These guys become, like, nationally famous. I didn't remember anything about it. This was, you know, I just was went right past me because I don't have any friends and I don't watch TV, so I never know what's going on in broad culture. But apparently these guys were a big deal in the late 70s. And very extroverted, nice-looking kids. And so what do we see? We see that they're incredibly similar. And they said, it's like looking at themselves. They become fast friends. They're all, you know, entertaining, funny, smart, verbal, extroverted. It's extraordinary to watch it. And then it turns out life goes on. One of them gets depressed, kills himself, you know. So some shit happens. And these guys are, like, bitter. They find out that they had been separated at birth by this, you know, evil genius that did this to them, and that the evil genius won't release the records about what the findings were of all the psychological observations that they did of them. It's like the dum-dum. They didn't find anything, okay? The study blew up in the psychiatrist's face when you guys met, and the whole world finds out that you're basically the same. It didn't make a damn bit of difference who your parents were. So this is what was obviously found out. Now, what happens next is interesting. The kids get bitter because they feel like, ooh, I was subject of a, you know, investigation, how terrible, how harmful and hurtful this was. Well, that's bullshit, okay? Second of all, oh, the terrible trauma of being separated at birth. No, it's not terribly traumatic. There's no, you didn't know you were separated at birth. And so you wouldn't have any idea that anything happened. The idea that something that happens early in your first few weeks of life imprints on your brain and impacts your emotional life is totally ridiculous and completely contradicted by all scientific evidence. It's ridiculous. Now, it psychodynamically makes sense, but it doesn't make any sense in biology and doesn't make any sense at all to common sense in general. If you have a bad 6 weeks in your life, no big deal. Okay, you don't even remember yet a bad 6 weeks. So here's what goes on next. What goes on next is that these guys want to seal the records. So the records of these guys and some other twins that they had studied wind up being sealed, and they'll be unveiled at Yale University in like 2066. Like, oh, what's in the record? Friends, nothing's in the record. The young psychologist, they had one that was involved in the observations that collected the data, and they interviewed him. He's like, yeah, I was watching these kids, and I watched them all, and I'm taking data on them. It's like kind of weird because I was just watching your brother last week, and, God, he's a hell of a lot like you. The guy was really open about it. He wasn't doing anything unethical from his standpoint. And as far as he knew, he was just there to document these different twin behaviors. And these twins were separated at birth, and, hey, he's just taking data. Well, I know what data he took. It's Bailey scales or Wechsler scales and different kinds of little, you know, I don't know, the Rorschach test, like, ooh, that's a big deal, okay? Bottom line is that what they got was these kids are really hell of similar. They're all having these similar, pretty decent, happy lives because that's who they are. And then they grow up, and they're incredibly similar when they meet each other at 18, 19, 20 years old, unbelievably similar. And then what happens? What happens is that they want to seal the records. What deep down thing did they find in the records? They found that, guess what? They're similar. So the reason why this idiot does not want that released, he died recently anyway, the old psychiatrist that engineered this fiasco, was that there was a vastly better way to do this research. And by 1985, it had been done. And it had been done by Abe Telligen and people like, you know, Robert Plowman and all these guys at the University of Minnesota, that they showed that monozygotic twins raised apart, you know, wind up unbelievably similar, and that when you have people adopted in, you know, when they're adopted in to families, they do not take on characteristics of the adults or children that are in those families. Okay, that's what's been done. Drop dead evidence. No contradiction to that evidence. This guy ran his own rogue study. he actually did it beyond what the Minnesota Twin Studies did. In other words, he actually intervened with his psychodynamic vision to try to prove that the type of parent that you adopt a kid into is going to have this profound impact on the child's development. He knew that it did not. And when those kids became rock stars on the front of Time magazine in 1979, it's like, oh my God, my grand theory just went up in smoke, because look at them. They're all the same. They're unbelievably similar. Okay? So the reason why this guy turned like a gopher and headed for the dirt and took the data with him was because he ran a really shitty, unethical study, and he got quietly humiliated that his grand psychodynamic theory was obviously disproven. And if that wasn't enough, the great research that would settle the question forever would be published 4 years later in the mid-1980s to set the record straight forever. So if anybody at the end of the end, incredible that those filmmakers couldn't manage to choke that out, because it doesn't make a good story, okay? So they wind up with a hokey little, you know, story at the end, and they're all acting like it's all a great mystery and it's all unfair that it's going to be sealed and what's in the record. Friends, there's nothing in the record. Nothing at all interesting in that record. And if you want to know what the truth is about how this works, you just read Abe Telligen and you read the Minnesota Twin Studies, you read the adoption studies, and it's very clear how it all works. So unfortunately for these kids, they wind up feeling a different kind of a feeling, like they were, I don't know, lab rats of some kind. It's not a good feeling to feel, but it doesn't do you any damage. And in fact, I think, unfortunately, a bitterness that comes out of them, and a bitterness that may have rocked one of them into this suicide that he did, was that because they became so novel and such rock stars very early in life, that the novelty and interest behind them was bound to wane. And so this is the equivalent of, you know, youthful, you know, you do some stupid sitcom when you're 19 years old and suddenly you're an international, you know, phenomenon, and it turns out you're not even very talented. And now pretty soon, what do we got? We got problems. You're a mess, okay? And I think life was actually hard on these kids because of the extraordinary adulation and excitement that came around them and the attention. And essentially, they wound up over-rewarded because as individuals, there's nothing that particularly special or interesting thing about these kids. They had no particularly great achievements at all. And yet they were massively rewarded into celebrityhood. And then when you do that and then it doesn't back up because you really can't sing and you really can't dance and you really can't rock and roll, and what are you going to do? You're a celebrity with no reason for you to be a celebrity. And so I think that is responsible for the suicide probably more than anything else. And anybody that's looking for anything deeper in the terrible aspects of this thing is looking in the wrong place. So that's my analysis of the Identical Strangers movie. I think for anybody that's interested in behavior genetics, it is a fascinating movie to watch, because you're not looking at actors, you're looking at the real thing. And when you see it, it's an amazing sight. All right.
Dr. Lyle, fantastic. I like your movie reviews. They're nice. I still have to watch Casablanca, though. I have never watched that movie.
How hard can I push it? Jeez. All right.
All right, Dr. Lyle. Excellent.
Great to hear
we'll
you.
Talk to you next week.
Will do. I'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.